that land it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confirm. So speak out loud of the things you are proud of. Love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confirm.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Freeman, who is a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Jimmy Carter. He also headed the New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and company. David Freeman is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider Shows How. Welcome to the program, David Freeman. And apparently we don't have him. I spoke to David a little while ago, so he's definitely expecting our call. So hopefully he will join us momentarily. And in the meantime, I'm trying to figure out whether we have him or not. Obviously, I wanted to talk to him and will talk to him, presuming he shows we get him on the line here, about the couple of issues that came up in President's speech yesterday at Georgetown University, where he called upon – he said that his administration was going to take the global lead in assaulting, is actually the word he used, climate change, and redouble U.S. efforts to join in the fight. And he specifically talked about setting carbon pollution standards for coal-fired plants, which are starting to be phased out now, largely because of the availability of natural gas. Nevertheless, of course, this has led to fierce opposition from the coal states. And he's also, for the first time, talked about the Keystone XL pipeline, which has been obviously a very controversial issue. And he didn't exactly say how he was going to vote. He said that if the Keystone XL pipeline adds to the CO2, then he would be against it. Now, the Canadians are already saying, their energy minister is already saying it's – the State Department has already said that it won't, but the State Department are reviewing it. So the real question is, what is the renewed or the new improved version of the State Department's study into Keystone XL going to lead to? And specifically what the president said, he said, by the way, it's certainly got to be about more than just building one pipeline. Now, I know there's been, for example, a lot of controversy surrounding the proposal to build the pipeline, the Keystone pipeline, that would carry oil from Canadian tar sands down to refineries in the Gulf. And the State Department is going through the final stages of evaluating the proposal. That's how it's always going to be. But I do want to be clear, allowing the Keystone pipeline to be built requires finding that doing so would be in our nation's interest, and our national interest will be served only if this project does not significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution. The net effects of the pipeline's impact on our climate will be absolutely critical to determining whether this project is allowed to go forward. So that is I don't know whether that satisfies anybody's concerns one way or the other, because it doesn't exactly say what he's going to do over this. So we'll see whether or not he is able to use the State Department authorization one way or the other. But as I say, the Canadians seem to think that the ruling is going to go in their favor. And, of course, this is a very conservative, pro-energy government now in Canada, under a prime minister from the oil state of Alberta. And again, we were hoping to talk about the president's speech yesterday. And his speech, of course, was on an opportunity for him to clarify his position on the environment. It turns out that in a recent poll, 47% of Americans think the government is doing too little to protect the environment. And that is certainly the case. And it would seem that if the president rules in favor of the Keystone Pipeline, I think he's going to take a huge hit from the environmental community, and that number may well go up. Again, we're hoping to get David Freeman on the line. Again, we're trying to talk about the important issue of what the president said yesterday. Of course, yesterday we had to cover the extraordinary ruling from the Supreme Court striking down the key part of the Voting Rights Act, which was probably one of the great disasters in terms of Supreme Court rulings since Citizens United. It's certainly on the, it will prove to be on a similar scale. And just as Citizens United has helped the Republican Party enormously, I don't think there's much doubt that this will also be an extraordinary boon for the Republicans, who will be able to suppress votes in enormous amounts of, particularly in the southern states, but also in a lot of the other red states. So we're still hoping to hear from David Freeman here, and I'm absolutely mystified as to why we can't get him on the line. Again, this is a background briefing. This is, unfortunately, a live show. I don't know why this is happening, and it's difficult to communicate here because I'm somewhat at a loss to know what is happening. But hopefully soon we will find out one way or the other whether we have David Freeman. Okay, well, apparently he's somehow not answering the phone. Maybe we should try somebody else on a on another subject, if we can. This is unfortunate because David's an old friend of mine. I've known him for years. It's absolutely mystifying to me as to why he is not on the line. I spoke to him a little while ago, so he was definitely wanting to do this. And, of course, he's played a very real role in trying to stop the nuclear power plant down here, south of here, San Diego, from being reopened. And as it happened, I mean, obviously other people are involved, but indeed the utility only finally came to their senses and decided to close the plant. And now, of course, I think efforts will be made to try and close down the other one at Diablo Canyon. So I'm telling you what I was talking to David about discussing here today before he came on, before I came on the air. And again, we're hoping that at some point or other we either get David on or we move on maybe to talk to somebody else about these Supreme Court rulings. We are going to try some other people here. Again, this is a live program, and for some reason or other, one of our live guests didn't show, and I have absolutely no idea why that is happening. But I'm going to try and hope that we bring you somebody here very soon. This is unfortunate that we weren't able to cover the president's speech on the environment yesterday. So at any rate, now we're going to go back to the other subject that we were talking about earlier, which is the Supreme Court rulings, and I have, which came out, of course, today. I have Jessica Levinson on, who's a professor at Loyola Law School, where she focuses on election law and governance issues, including campaign finance, ethics, and state budgets. She wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court in McCormish versus Bennett, the case in which John Roberts and four other justices ruled to limit public funding in elections. And she's the editor of the blog Polawtics, that's polawtics.com, and has an article. Well, thank you so much for joining us at this last minute, Jessica. I'm so glad to have somebody to talk to. I was getting tired of talking to myself.
I'm so glad to talk to you, as always. So this is working out well already.
So we were speaking earlier with a law professor at Stanford, who was on these two rulings, and I asked her about this odd mix in the rulings in terms of the makeup of that court. You know, you had the four who are called liberal justices, and by the way, we discussed the idea of them being called liberals, which the press do routinely in referring to the four minorities on the minority four on the court. that is indeed a misnomer, that there aren't any liberals on the court. They are moderates. But in terms of the Doma ruling, Justice Kennedy joined the four moderates, but then on the other Prop 8, denying the appeal on Prop 8, you had a strange mixture of Kennedy being on the other side with some of the very conservative judges, and Roberts being on the other side with some of the liberal judges. So let's start with that. What did you make of that odd mixture, and particularly the dissent that came from Kennedy in the Prop 8 case that indicated he was concerned about a federal judge overturning the will of the people in a state referendum?
Well, I mean, first, what do I make of the difference in the breakdown of the justices? Well, you know, two totally different cases that have been lumped together because they both deal with equal rights, with gay rights. But in fact, the Prop 8 case, as you know, and likely just talked about at length, the Perry case has nothing to do with the gay rights. It has to do with standing of ballot measure proponents. So in that case, I think actually it's not at all surprising that there would be an entirely different split in the court. This is the criticism of the Prop 8 decision, and this will continue to be the criticism. You know, the argument goes, well, there's a ballot measure, it's passed by 90% of the electorate, and then if the Attorney General and the governor don't like it and fail to defend it, essentially one trial court judge can overturn the will of the people. That's not how I see this, but I think that's certainly been the criticism of that certainly has been and will be the criticism of the Prop 8 decision.
And what could happen then if this? I mean, there's still some work to be done, clearly, the ruling could be just narrowed to the four plaintiffs involved, the couple in Burbank and the couple up in Berkeley, and unless there's some clarity. And the Attorney General, Kamala Harris, has asked for some clarity from the Ninth Circuit. But our earlier guest was saying that maybe some clerks in various parts of the state might decide, you know, on their own that they don't approve of it. So when do you think the clarity will come? Obviously, people can't rush out and get married.
Right. So usually it takes the Ninth Circuit about 25 days to lift a stay. Kamala Harris, as you know, has asked for an expedited lifting of that stay. You know, so there was some chatter before the decision came out. If it's based on standing, is it going to be that it was just the plaintiffs from Alameda and Los Angeles County, that it would be just in those jurisdictions where Prop 8 was overturned? It looks to me, as the news and analysis progresses throughout the day, that this is really going to be applicable to all of California, in large part because the governor, who was ironically the attorney general who failed to defend Prop 8, and the new attorney general are very forcefully saying Prop 8 is invalid in California, period, not in portions of California. But, you know, to get back to your broader point of where do we go from here, well, you know, this is not a strong statement in favor of gay rights. This is a strong statement that says if you come to federal court, you better have an injury, it better be caused by what you're complaining about, and we better be able to remedy it if we give you a favorable outcome. So, you know, that's what this decision hinges on. And I think, frankly, the criticism is a bit misplaced because the judge did in this case exactly what members of the judiciary are supposed to do. They are supposed to be the last stop on the train to tyranny of the majority, and the ballot initiative process can lead to majoritarian oppression. And what the court did here is it looked at the Equal Protection Clause, you know, District Court Judge Vaughn Walker, and he said, no, this violates the Equal Protection Clause. Prop 8 is invalid. And that now becomes the law of the land in California, I think. And the Supreme Court's decision becomes the law of the entire nation when it comes to ballot measure proponent standing.
So Kennedy was joined in the dissent on the Prop 8, denying the appeal on Prop 8, and likely opening, clearing the way for same-sex marriage here in the state of California. He was joined by Clarence Thomas and Sonia Sotomayor, who's on the moderate side. And, of course, Clarence Thomas and Justice Alito are extremely conservative. So that was the strange mix. But in the other case, Scalia was very upset and sort of ranting about sodomy and stuff like that. So what was his what did you make of his dissent in
In the Doma case. The Doma case, the Windsor case, is the case that actually deals with what we're talking about, which is gay rights. And as I'm sure you've discussed, that case says, you know, the federal government doesn't get to deny same-sex couples that are legally married in their state federal benefits, Social Security benefits. In this case, the Windsor case had to deal with estate taxes. So there are a lot of federal benefits that people like me who are married to someone of the opposite sex get, which as of yesterday, same-sex couples couldn't get. And this is the more classic liberal-conservative divide that people expected to see. Kennedy, you know, it's the Kennedy court. So Kennedy is joins the, as you will say, moderate wing. And then we see the kind of conventional, what we all expect, conservative wing. This is not a surprise from Justice Scalia. He has moral problems with gay marriage. I'm trying to be somewhat euphemistic here, and he really had a big problem with the fact that the court did not just apply a lower level of scrutiny, and that's what I think the big story is coming out of DOMA, which is that the majority actually applied a fairly heightened standard of review, saying, we're really going to look at this law with a suspicious eye. And what Justice Scalia said is, no, we really should give the federal government the benefit of the doubt here. Justice Scalia being upset with the outcome and saying, you should have applied something more akin to rational basis.
I brought it up because I, in a curious way, what Scalia was saying is that you have to, you know, you can't trample on the feelings of people who are in the dissent. And in many ways, I thought, curiously enough, that could apply to the Prop 8 ruling because it did pass by a majority of 52% in the state of California. But then, if you had it over again, my understanding is that current polling indicates that Prop 8 would be voted down substantially. So I'm just wondering whether it's healthy for a country to have a look. Well, after the ruling yesterday, let's face it, the minorities have got being shafted in the most blatant way. But the idea that you leave people high and dry, maybe it's a better thing to do to for the state of California to go ahead and have another referendum. I guess it's not likely, though, right?
I think it's probably not likely after the ruling here, but, you know, as you said, a big part of the story is the initiative process in California. And a big part of the story, I mean, what you're bringing up, I think, is so important, and I'm not going to be the first or last law professor to say this, which is, you know, the conservative members of the court tend to care a lot about states' rights in certain cases, and then they don't. So, you know, we can certainly pick apart the decisions that came out in the last 2 days. I mean, the Voting Rights Act decision, I think, very disappointing on a number of levels, but the court didn't actually go as far as it could have. And then these decisions, again, what we're talking about in large part, as you said, is a power play between what do the people get to do through the initiative process when they're standing in the shoes of legislators, these citizen legislators, what do our state legislators, our elected representatives get to do, and then what do our federal representatives get to do? And the judiciary is typically the arbiter of that power play. I think your question brings up the problem of, are the members of the court always consistent on this? And I think the answer has to be no.
Well, I thank you for stepping in here and helping us out, Jessica. I'm very grateful.
Always. It's always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Jessica Levinson, who teaches law at Loyola University, and she has joined us here at the last minute. We're about to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the renewed Republican war on women's reproductive rights.